Case number 22-7204, Terry V. Wright, appellant, versus Eugene and Agnes E. Meyer Foundation, and Nicola O. Gorin. Mr. Sells for the appellant, Ms. Davies for the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the court, my name is Derek Sells, and I'm very proud to be representing Dr. Terry Wright in this matter. Today, I'd like to present four issues. Number one, related to the dismissal of her complaint, that the district court erred when it dismissed plaintiff's complaint and claim for violation of 42 U.S.C. Section 1981, where the facts in the complaint permitted a reasonable inference that defendant Gorin disparaged her in violation of the party severance agreement because of racial animus. Second, that the district court erred under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 12b6 when it dismissed plaintiff's complaint and claim for violation of 42 U.S.C. Section 1981, where the complaint provided defendants with fair notice of the basis for her Section 1981 claim. Third, that the district court erred when it dismissed plaintiff's complaint and claim for breach of contract, where the complaint properly pleaded defendants breached the mutual non-disparagement provision of the party severance agreement, and the district court wrongly held that no such breach occurred, and thereby nullified the terms of the non-disparagement provision of the contract. And then fourth, that the district court erred under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 12b6 when it utilized the common interest privilege to dismiss plaintiff's complaint and claim for defamation, where the common interest privilege is defeated by the complaint's allegations of intentional racial discrimination, and that where there was no common interest between defendants and non-party Mady Henson, Dr. Mady Henson.
Can I clarify your Section 1981 claim, counsel? If you don't prevail that there was actually at least adequately pled a breach of contract, then you can't prevail on the 1981 claim, right? Because you have to interfere with a contract, and if there's no contract, then you can't have the 1981 violation, right? Am I right about that?
No, Your Honor, we respectfully disagree with that. I think under the fair notice provision case law that we've given notice that this is a 1981 violation, regardless of whether or not there was a breach of the severance agreement. Here, we allege that that Dr. Wright was treated differently than white members of the Meyer Foundation, white employees of the Meyer Foundation. And in particular, what we allege is that the statement that was made by defendant Gorin to Dr. Henson was one that was equivalent to a situation where a former employer gives a negative review or a negative employment justification or verification or a negative statement about their work to a potential employer. Here, once Dr. Wright was no longer employed by the Meyer Foundation, and because she worked in the philanthropic community, the statement to Bragg's then president was one that denied her the opportunity to potentially get a job there. And under the case law that we cited, that constitutes a 1981 violation.
So assume for the sake of this argument that I just want to drill down on the breach of contract claim because I'm not so certain about that theory of 1981. How was the statement made a breach of contract by the foundation as opposed to an act for which Ms. Gorin individually could be liable?
Right. The contract itself called for mutual non-disparagement. And as such, the foundation itself was bound not to disparage Dr. Wright. Under the terms of the contract, the obligation was for not only, in our view, not only to tell the officers of the corporation not to disparage, but once those officers were told and Ben did disparage, that bound the company. If I could use an example, Your Honor. Let's say, for example, the Meyer Foundation had contracted with a vendor to receive services. And as part of that contract, the foundation indicated that upon receiving the services and the invoice for those services, it would direct its bookkeeper to make payment. Okay? The services were rendered. The foundation itself directed its bookkeeper to make payment. But then the bookkeeper didn't make payment. So now the vendor sues the foundation, said, hey, we didn't get paid. And then the foundation says, well, wait a minute. All we said we do is direct the bookkeeper to make payment. If she pays it or doesn't pay it, that's on her. We're not responsible. Notwithstanding the fact that the foundation got the benefit of those services. And that's what we have here. We have Dr. Wright agreeing not to disparage the foundation. And she lived up to it. She provided her word, she lived up to her word, and gave the foundation non-disparagement. The foundation then directed its officer, presumably Defendant Gorman, not to disparage Dr. Wright. And yet she does. And we say that because of it, the foundation is just as responsible as if the bookkeeper didn't pay the bills. And I'm certain that under this court's precedent, that if the vendor in that scenario that I came up with sues the foundation and says that they owe money for the services that we provided, notwithstanding what their bookkeeper may have done or not, that this court would say, you owe the money. You got the service, you got them, and you owe the money. Because you cannot render or read a contract that renders it a nullity. There has to be some provision by which Dr. Wright can get redressed. And so I hope I've answered your Honor's question. With regard to...
Did you allege a violation of the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing? Or you're just alleging a violation of the terms of the non-disparagement provision?
I think it's incorporated. I don't know if we set those terms exactly in our complaint. But under this court's jurisdiction, under this court's case law, under this Columbia case law, read into every single agreement is the requirement of a duty of good faith and fair dealing.
That may be read into contracts, but alleging a breach of contract, people can allege it in two different ways. They can allege a breach of the terms of the contract, or they can allege a breach of the duty of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. But they're usually two separate allegations, I think. Is there a case where we've said that alleging a breach necessarily encompasses both?
Well, I don't know. I know we cite cases, Your Honor. We believe that the cases that we cite go to the proposition that when you allege a breach of contract, that gives fair notice that it would be, you know, either a breach of the specific terms of the contract or a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And so I don't know that necessarily we're required to state which at the pleading stage. And so maybe, you know, as we go further, as, you know, discovery is allowed, you know, we'll be able to amend our complaint if that's required, but I don't think at this stage, Your Honor, that that is a requirement. We allege a breach, and we set forth why.
Let's suppose that breach of good, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is a separate theory of liability than breach of the, you know, express terms of the contract. Is it your contention that that there is no breach of the express terms of the contract, and that it's only a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
No, I mean, I think that there is a breach of the explicit terms of the contract as well. One of the things that the district court did not do is address the term that's in the contract of mutual non-disparagement. Okay, that term is what it is. It's mutual. It goes both ways. It's not one way and not the other. And so in that sense, yes, we allege that there was a breach of the specific terms of the contract when Nikki Gorin disparaged Dr. Wright. So I hope I've answered your question. Yeah.
How long does the promise to direct last? And here's what I'm thinking. I might direct myself to brush my teeth every day for the rest of my life, but I might be good on that for a few days, but then after a while, I slip up and I get out of that habit. Have I breached the order to myself? Let's say the order is brush your teeth, or maybe this is actually, I didn't really phrase this the way I wanted to. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's not your fault if you don't.
I think if Your Honor is asking whether or not there's a time limit on how long this particular term of the contract.
That's a much better put.
I say that the requirement lasts forever. That there is a duty, a mutual duty, not to disparage one another.
Why is that the case rather than, we promise to direct our employees and directors not to disparage Dr. Wright? We will direct them. Today we will direct them to do that. And after today, no promises.
Well, that's not what the terms of the contract say.
It doesn't say forever, and it doesn't say only for a day.
It says mutual. What mutual means, I think, a reasonable fact line. What mutual means is equal. And so as long as Dr. Wright is bound by the terms of this contract, so is the foundation and its officer. And so if Dr. Wright could be sued on her deathbed at age 99, because she's disparaged the Maya Foundation or any of the officers of the Maya Foundation, then likewise, the Maya Foundation should be required to do the same. I see that I'm over my time, dude.
Okay,
do
you have any questions right now? We'll give you a couple minutes on rebuttal. How about that?
All right, thank you.
Ms. Davis?
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'd like to address a couple of issues that Mr. Sellers raised in response to some questions posed by the panel. First of all, I agree that the issue here, based on the complaint that was filed, is whether or not there was a breach of the severance contract. The complaint explicitly states that Dr. Wright has brought this case because of a breach of the severance contract. Now, Mr. Sellers, it would like to focus on the title of section of paragraph 6 of the severance contract that says mutual non-disparagement and completely disregard the substance of paragraph 6 that specifically sets forth the obligations of each of the parties to the severance contract.
It seems like you want to look at those sentences, but ignore the name of the provision, the mutual non-disparagement. So both of you only want to look at part of the provision. What's mutual about non-disparagement under this contract?
Sorry, both parties agreed not to disparage, and the nature of that obligation is spelled out in the substance of paragraph 6.
So the foundation did agree not to disparage.
What the foundation agreed under the paragraph mutual non-disparagement was to direct its officers, directors, and employees with direct knowledge of the revised letter agreement not to make any false, disparaging, or derogatory statements.
That's not the same thing as an agreement not to disparage. Right? I can tell my kids to make their bed, but that does not mean the bed is made. And it would not be someone else was, if my husband was agreeing to make our bed, it would not be a mutual bed-making agreement, because all I would do is agree to tell the kids to make the bed, but do nothing to require that it happens or to enforce it.
The agreement between the parties was how the foundation could perform its obligation not to disparage when you're dealing with several officers, directors, and employees. And to avoid that paragraph being illusory, the foundation committed to that it would direct its officers, directors, and employees not to disparage in order to achieve Dr. Wright's goal of not being disparaged.
So let's suppose the foundation signs this agreement, and then immediately after the agreement, they send a notice out to all their employees and officers, do not disparage Dr. Wright. And then 5 minutes after they send that notice out, they issue a statement from the board of directors and the president and CEO that says, you know, Wright was a terrible employee and she was toxic and we had to fire her. Et cetera, et cetera. Have they complied with the contract?
Responding to that hypothetical, because that is not what occurred here, but yes, they would have complied with their obligation under paragraph 6.
And you think that that's a reasonable construction of the contract? Because under DC law, isn't that like our first obligation is to determine what reasonable people in the position of the parties, knowing all the facts and circumstances, would have agreed to? So you think that if we undertook that exercise, that would be a reasonable construction of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be, especially given the circumstances that Dr. Wright had the opportunity to negotiate the language in the mutual non-disparagement clause. To the extent that there was any ambiguity that Dr. Wright was concerned about, she could have proposed alternate language to the foundation to clarify any ambiguity. She did not. She signed this agreement knowing that the obligation that the foundation committed to was to direct their officers, directors, and employees.
So the person signed the agreement on behalf of the foundation was a Dr. Horn, right? Because she was president and CEO and she signed it?
At the time, she signed it in her capacity as president and CEO of the foundation.
Then about 30 days after she signed this agreement, she made the statements, right? At least that according to
correct. That is what is alleged.
And so you don't think that there's a plausible argument there then that at least if anyone on behalf of the foundation shouldn't have been making a statement, it should be the president and CEO and the person who signed the mutual disparagement clause. You don't think that that's a plausible breach of contract theory?
There is no evidence that the foundation didn't perform its obligation to instruct and that Ms. Gorin didn't, knowing as the signatory to this agreement, didn't instruct herself that she would not disparage. and not.
She did or did not. Sorry, I want to make sure I heard she did or did not instruct herself.
There's no allegation that she did not instruct herself or intentionally disregarded this provision, that she signed it and then went on and made a comment knowing that this obligation that the foundation had taken on existed. There's no allegation in the complaint.
Would the president CEO be the natural person to send out this notice to employees?
It could go out from the CEO, it could go out from the COO, it could go out from the board chair.
So it's an open factual question whether if she sent it out, whether she would have sent a copy to herself.
Well, there's no factual issue that was raised by Dr. Wright in this case that the instructions were not given.
No, but the question is whether Dr. Gorin was instructed not to do it. Was the person who sent the notice, was him or herself instructed not to speak? Because usually that's not how things work, right? You don't really send it to you don't direct yourself to do something. So isn't that sort of just an open fact question here?
That is an open fact issue, but Dr. Wright has not alleged that obligation was not performed. If they had a basis for believing that the foundation did not perform its obligation, it would have been alleged in the complaint.
Well, no, what I'm trying to understand is that it sounds like the obligation could be performed if Dr. Gorin sent this notice out to all the employees, but didn't include herself as a recipient as opposed to the sender. So she didn't receive this instruction herself. She just sent it to everybody else. And then.
Ms. Gorin would have been aware of this obligation since she signed the agreement.
Oh, but the contract doesn't say who's aware. It says all they have to do is send out the instruction. It doesn't matter whether people are, under your theory, as I take it, it doesn't matter whether people are aware of it when they, and they nonetheless make a disparaging statement. But the question is whether Ms. Gorin herself would have been directed not to speak disparagingly. If she wasn't directed, but she's speaking as she is the voice of the foundation, then it seems to me there's a problem with the concept of mutual non-disparagement.
The obligation that the foundation assumed in paragraph 6 would be to direct. It doesn't obligate the foundation to send anything out in writing, but to make officers, directors, and employees aware that they are not to disparage.
So the provision says it's a mutual non-disparagement, and then the first sentence says that Dr. Wright will not make false, disparaging, derogatory statements about the foundation to anyone except in the course of a governmental investigation or litigation. And then it says, likewise, and then it says the foundation will direct people not to make statements. So the fact that it's called mutual non-disparagement and the foundation's obligations are treated with the word likewise, you think that there's no reasonable construction of that language that would mean that court or a fact finder could undertake to find liability when the person on behalf of the foundation signing the statement actually makes a signing the contract or actually makes a disparaging statement?
Correct, because the obligations under this agreement go to Dr. Wright and to the foundation. They are the parties to this agreement.
Did Dr. Wright promise to refrain from disparaging anyone?
Did Dr. Wright
promise
not to to make any disparagement. Yes, she did.
But who did she promise not to disparage?
She promised not to disparage any person or entity.
Any person in the foundation, and not to disparage the foundation as an entity.
Right. Or any of the releasees.
I am trying to figure out why this language is the language that was used in the contract. One theory is that it's just boilerplate language. It's standard, and this happens all the time. Another theory is that this language was really not very generous to Dr. Wright, and that was part of a bargained for negotiation where maybe in exchange for some better part of the contract elsewhere, Dr. Wright gave up a disparagement clause with more teeth. And then the third possibility, and I can only think of three, but you might be able to think of more. The third possibility is that she just had a really poor attorney. And so let's take that one out of it. Let's say that she had a good attorney for the sake of this hypothetical. Do you know if this language is boilerplate? And if it's not boilerplate, is it reasonable on the record before us to think that she might have gotten something like a larger severance payment in exchange for this not very generous disparagement?
So mutual non-disparagement clauses are difficult to negotiate when you're dealing with large organizations like the foundation, where there are multiple levels and organizations and an inability to police everybody at each level of the organization. And so as part of the negotiating process, sometimes in this case, the employee is willing to negotiate language, what is found in paragraph 6, recognizing that the reality is there might be a low-level person, for example, a front desk person who makes a...
I'm going to interrupt you, Ms. Davis, and if my interruption messes up an answer that you then think is going to be helpful, I'd welcome it. But let me see if maybe I didn't phrase it right. Is this language boilerplate? Do you know if this language is standard?
I don't know if it's boilerplate for the foundation, but I do know that frequently when negotiating employment severance agreements and an employee wants a non-disparagement provision, this is a concession that is made because it's the easiest way for the employer to actually take steps to try and ensure that there is no disparagement by key decision makers.
But you just said in response to my hypothetical that it would be completely consistent with this contract for the board to send out an email to everyone, including themselves, saying, do not disparage Dr. Wright. And then 5 minutes later, the board sending out an email to the world or posting on Twitter to the world that Dr. Wright is terrible and disparaging her, right? Didn't you just answer me that would be consistent with the contract, or am I misunderstanding your prior answer?
I think you may have misunderstood my response, or I may have misunderstood the hypothetical, in that the obligation was to direct certain key employees and directors who had knowledge of the severance agreement not to make any false or disparaging comments. So the foundation could send out a directive to that group, that subgroup. Shortly thereafter, if the foundation then sent out some type of communication that disparaged Dr. Wright, I believe that Dr. Wright at that point might have a basis for arguing that there was a misrepresentation in the negotiation of the agreement as to what the intent was here. That going in, that the foundation intended to engage in some type of subterfuge and fool her into signing this agreement and giving up her rights when they did not intend to honor efforts to ensure that she was not disparaged.
How is that any different than a breach of contract claim?
So the difference is that she would have to allege that the foundation did not intend to comply or perform the obligations set forth in paragraph 6, which were intended to avoid avoid disparagement comments, derogatory comments being made about Dr. Wright.
Why wouldn't
it would be a different claim than what Dr. Wright has brought?
Why wouldn't a claim of breaching the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing not encompass exactly what you just raised, conceded could be raised?
It could encompass that, but that was not alleged in this case. So going back
to BC law does not require an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing to be separately alleged as a cause of action, which is just encompassed within a breach of contract claim. Then at the pleading stage here, she may not have any such facts, but at the pleading stage here, she would have exactly what you said would be sufficient to object to a soon after signing disparagement by the one person who absolutely knew there was a mutual non-disparagement clause.
But for purposes of a motion to dismiss, the foundation and Ms. Gorin did not have noticed that Dr. Wright was attempting to bring a claim of breach of good faith and fair dealing.
That's encompassed, as counsel said, counsel for Ms. Wright said, if that's just encompassed with any contractual obligation, if he alleges a breach of contract. Breaches of contract take two forms, the letter of the contract and the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. We're talking about local law here, so if district law does not require you to plead as a distinct cause of action, the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, just to plead a breach of contract, then that would be met here for purposes of 12b6 dismissal.
But Dr. Wright did not plead a general breach of contract claim. Here, there were specific allegations to a breach of the explicit terms of the severance contract. And upon being advised of deficiencies in the pleading of that claim, Dr. Wright did not amend the complaint.
But one of the express terms is mutual non-disparage.
Correct.
So if she's saying, I'm agree, that's what I think was breached here, whether textually or as a matter of implied of duty of good faith and fair dealing, for the exact reasons you just said in response to Judge Wilkins.
But the fact that
wouldn't that suffice under, do you have any case where that wouldn't suffice under district law?
I do not have any case, but we're happy to submit supplemental briefing.
Can I ask you a separate question on this common interest question? What evidence is there that Ms. Gorin's statement was intended to advance or protect the interests of WRAG, or that WRAG had a corresponding interest, a similar interest to Dr. Gorin in this situation? Plaintiff established that their interests were corresponding as opposed to potentially adverse.
So the allegation relates to the fact that Ms. Gorin was the board chair for RAG, the Washington Regional Association of Grant Makers, and that this alleged comment was raised during a conversation between the president, Dr. Henson, and Ms. Gorin, in which Dr. Henson mentioned to Ms. Gorin that there was concerns being raised in the grant making community about the circumstances of Dr. Wright's termination. So that, context explains why Ms. Gorin felt necessary to respond to that question and explain why the rumors were not true.
I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that the sequence here was that Ms. Gorin first raised, it was just a side conversation, and Ms. Gorin first raised this, I'm feeling all this heat. And then Ms. Henson and Ms. Dr. Henson responded, yeah, there's a lot going around in the community about concerns here about racial discrimination. And so Ms. Gorin initiates it. Dr. Henson responds, just talking about what's going on in the community. And at that point, Ms. Gorin says, oh, well, here's what was going on. Do I have it wrong?
The sequencing is correct. The characterization, I think, I disagree with, in that Ms. Gorin mentioned to Dr. Henson, again, the board chair and the president, that she was feeling the pressure. And then Dr. Henson was the one who mentioned the fact that there was discussion in the grant-making community about the circumstances of Dr. Wright's termination from the foundation.
The WRAG is committed to the funding that it does is to root out discrimination, to expose it, to root it out, to try to prevent it. And Ms. Gorin's statement were to justify Ms. Gorin's actions. And in doing so, used terminology that could be, these are all disputable fact questions, but that could be consistent with stereotypical labeling of discomfort with successful Black women. And so how do we know there's a common interest between Ms. Gorin, who's trying to cover her decision, protect herself from the reaction of those involved in the civil rights community, and those who are dedicated to preventing and rooting out discrimination?
But if we take a look at the amended complaint that was filed in Dr. Henson's action against RAG, we'll see that she says that the statement that was made was merely that there was a negative climate. That was Ms. Gorin's only comment.
Yeah, but this complaint says
in this complaint, we have the embellishment of that conversation, but the court can take judicial notice of an individual who's not involved in this dispute and was personally involved in a conversation who said the sole comment was a negative climate.
Are you suggesting we can choose between those two versions of events at this stage?
I believe with respect to the comment that was made, Dr. Henson, who had personal knowledge, as the allegations in this dispute state, Dr. Wright had no personal knowledge of that supposed conversation until the complaint was filed almost a year later.
So you're saying we should resolve that factual dispute against Ms. Wright on the face of the complaint?
On the face of that complaint, yes.
All right. And another thing is common interest doesn't apply if someone is not acting in good faith. And there are allegations, and I hesitate to reaffirm, these are just allegations at this case stage. Nothing's been proven. But there are just allegations of racially discriminatory atmosphere at the foundation under Ms. Gorin, combined with an allegation of differential treatment of a white person who was discharged for similarly ambiguous reasons, didn't sort of share the vision. And so with those together, Why is that not enough to raise at the pleading stage a factual question on good faith for purposes of the common interest?
That is not sufficient because those supposed events are not closely related to the time when this alleged conversation took place.
A month, it was like 30 days.
We also have the fact, going back to what I stated earlier about the relationship between Ms. Gorin and Dr. Henson, and the fact that, as noted, the REG is in the business of weeding out discrimination, that this conversation would not have occurred in the context of where there would be any type of racial animus.
And so we also have, if we're going to look at that other complaint, Ms. Henson accusing Ms. Gorin of leading to another racially discriminatory discharge. So we've got two allegations, racially discriminatory discharge, and allegations in the complaint about a racially discriminatory environment. And that's, in your position, it's not enough to plead a question of malice for purposes of the good faith prong of the common interest test.
The allegations raised solely in litigation in this context should not be sufficient.
You have a case that's why these allegations are not sufficient. Wait, I'm gonna back up. I assume you will agree that racially discriminatory comments constitute a lack of good faith for purposes of the common interest test. You don't have good faith if you're making your statements out of racial animus.
If there is racial animus that can be inferred from the comments, yes, that's correct.
And so if it can be inferred from the comments, but also there's allegations, there's allegations of other allegations of racially discriminatory conduct by the speaker, in this case, Ms. Gorin. Again, just allegations, but those allegations are there. That is not enough in your view to raise a question, to sufficiently show at the 12B6 stage, to state a claim that there was not good faith for purposes of the common interest privilege?
Yes, I do not believe those alleged incidents are sufficient for purposes of the Section 1981 claim that is brought with reference to a severance agreement. Those allegations were made in the context of the employment relationship. And in fact, Dr. Wright tries to separate the Meyer Foundation from Ms. Gorin. And so to the extent that allegation is that the foundation discriminated against her based on her race, I don't believe those allegations are sufficient to find liability under Section 1981.
No, but she has a separate, I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. She has a separate defamation claim, common law defamation.
I apologize. I went back to the 1981 claim.
That's my fault.
I still don't believe that those comments are sufficient because they are not tied to Ms. Gorin. They're talking about the foundation and the atmosphere at the foundation.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you. We've kept you up a long time, so thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sells, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I want to start with the common interest privilege. And I think, Your Honor, Judge Miller, you hit on the point that we raised in our brief, that the issue of common interest, if you get past the bad faith in the comment that Nikki Gorin made, Dr. Henson, and you look at the common interest, that is not common. You know, what Nikki Gorin is trying to do is cover her own self, trying to cover her own image. She was the head, the board, the director, to the board. She was the head of the board of directors for RAG. At the time that Dr. Henson came into RAG, there had just been a climate survey that had been taken, where it found that the climate of African-American employees in RAG was horrible. You had a employee, African-American employee, who was required and forced to give up her seat to a white contractor, not an employee, but a white contractor. You had a number of African-American employees at RAG who said that RAG was not a place of racial equity, that there was a segregated work environment. And that's when Dr. Henson took over, okay? And that organization was
headed. Sorry, I think you mean when Dr. Gorin took over.
No. Dr. Henson. She took over RAG as the CEO, not the board of directors, but the CEO. She took over. That was the climate at RAG. It was horrible. She was brought in to bring racial equity.
Well, I'm talking about the climate at the foundation, which is what your complaint talks about. And it says, under defendant Gorin's leadership, and then details the...
I'm looking at the Henson, the doctor.
Well, I want to talk about your complaint.
All right, no, I get it. Right. What I'm suggesting is that the motivation mm-hmm. from Nitti Gorin mm-hmm. to make those comments was not in RAG's best interest. It was mm-hmm. in Nitti Gorin's best interest. So the idea that the two had a common interest is just from this record, you cannot find it. It's not there. That's the only point I was making. So I went back to when Dr. Henson took over RAG, it was in a very bad place. It was a very discriminatory place. Just like when Dr. Wright obtained her position at the Meyer Foundation, there had been, right before Dr. Wright was brought in, there had been a climate survey at the Meyer Foundation that showed that African-American employees at the Meyer Foundation found that it was a toxic working environment for African-Americans.
Did your statement right there just violate Dr. Wright's obligation under the mutual non-disparagement paragraph? Or is
that's just in our complaint. It's in our complaint.
Does your complaint violate the agreement?
No, because it's in the complaint. So any statement in a complaint is permitted. I mean, if you're involved in litigation pursuant to the agreement, you're allowed to truthfully testify, or truthfully state what the allegations are. So it does not violate the terms of the agreement.
If it were outside the context of a complaint, would what you just said have violated the mutual non-disparagement?
Yeah, it would, yes. And but because this is in litigation over...
It overrides the...
Yeah, I mean, you're allowed to testify.
Well, or any, there's an exception for any litigation in the non-disparagement clause.
Yeah,
whether this kind or others.
Right, and so the idea of Nitti Gorin making these statements as it being in the common interest is just simply not you can't get that on these facts. And at a minimum, it raises a question of fact as to what is the common interest here. I just wanted to make that.
Who do the releasees refer to in the mutual non-disparagement paragraph? It's 827 of the appendix. It says, you agree that you will not make any disparaging statements regarding the foundation or any of the other releasees. And I don't know the answer.
I think what that refers to are the employees of the Meyer Foundation, which would include everybody who works for the foundation.
So JA-26 says its respective predecessors, successors, affiliates, subsidiaries, parent companies, and assigns, and all of their respective past and present directors, officers, partners, members, stockholders, plan administration, fiduciaries, insurers, agents, attorneys, and employees.
That covers a wide swath. Now, in terms of, I think, Your Honor,
you're going to need to wrap up here for us.
Okay. The last point is, to the extent that the agreement, the mutual non-disparagement language, is in, creates an imbalance but if there's ambiguity, if there's ambiguity in the language of the contract, it must be construed against the draft. In this case, the drafter was Nikki Gorin and the foundation. And we believe that as a result, again, as you look at the breach of contract, then you have to look at any ambiguity has to be looked at in favor of the non-draft.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.